I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 22nd of August. It is time for all things political. Heather McGee joins us again, director of the Washington office of Demos. We have a lot to talk about this hour. Donald Trump has a new campaign CEO, Steve Bannon, chair of the Breitbart news site. E.J. Dionne writes that Bannon will steer him in the direction of the European far right. Trump is still leading among white men without college degrees, and by 40 points, very large. We'll ask why. The Clinton Foundation is having its keynote annual event next month, a week before the first presidential debate. Some Democrats are dismayed by the timing. It highlights Hillary Clinton's vulnerability, ties to donations from Middle Eastern governments, like $10 million from Saudi Arabia, and major corporation donations that have business before the government. Donald Trump is calling on Clinton to shut down the foundation and return the donations to countries that he says influenced her totally while she was Secretary of State. A New York Times investigation reports Trump's companies have at least $650 million in debt. He's going to give a policy speech this week on immigration, which might not be as tough as what he started out with. And he's big. We're going to spend some time on this, on saying Democrats would win a stolen election through fraudulent voting. In Pennsylvania, he said the only way we can lose, in my opinion, I really mean this, Pennsylvania, is if cheating goes on. So we'll talk about all of that and much more during the course of the hour, and welcome your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Demos is a nonpartisan research and advocacy organization focusing on economic equality, democratic participation, and strengthening the public sector to find public solutions to shared problems. Heather is a frequent guest on Meet the Press, Hardball with Chris Matthews. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, and The Hill, and many other publications. And we welcome you again to the show, Heather. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Glad to be with you.
Why don't we start with Hillary Clinton? We frequently start with Donald Trump, who makes more headlines. But this Clinton Foundation having its keynote annual event next month, it's very close to the first presidential debate. And there are a lot of people who are concerned about this because of who will be there, how much it costs to be there, who's going to be rubbing noses with whom. And it also highlights her vulnerabilities. Do you think that it does?
It's, you know, I just want to thank you, Kathleen, for having this show, for having this really kind of thoughtful conversation with listeners all the time. It's really great.
Thanks, Heather.
Just want to say, as I'm talking here as president of Demos, I'm also talking as president of Demos Action, which is our sister organization, which just allows me to speak freely about the candidates during a political cycle.
Okay.
So all of that preamble to say, you know, when the Clintons, when Bill Clinton left office and the Clinton Foundation began, in some ways it's an interesting case study of the emergence of a new kind of global elite that was interested in public interest problems, right? Malaria, AIDS, women's equality, and was in many ways, and probably still is, you know, a benevolent force in terms of a way for corporate CEOs, world leaders, influential thought leaders to get around and get together and talk about the world's problems. In many ways, it's something like TED as well, mm-hmm. right? It's sort of this idea of the sort of global elite that cares about the public interest. There are, of course, major shortcomings to that as a theory for social change, right? It, by definition, excludes those who are not part of the global power elite. That said, it's not quite the same thing as, you know, the Koch brothers getting together to talk about how to make sure that we can't regulate carbon emissions in order to protect the planet. So we're living in a complicated world where, frankly, governments are having less of a you know, sort of ambition and ability, because of various things, including gridlock and austerity and corporate influence, to actually tackle some of the world's problems. So you've seen this sort of shift in the idea that, you know, let's get a bunch of CEOs around the table and be the ones to, you know, to take on the world's problems. And in many ways, the Clinton Foundation is a big sort of representative of that new ethos.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, though, that it causes problems for having this so close to, obviously, you know, Donald Trump is going to talk about this issue, and we've only seen the beginning of what he's going to say. Do you think that maybe, considering the fact that she's running for president, that maybe the 12th annual meeting here should be skipped?
I think that, you know, it probably couldn't hurt for there to not be a reason to, you know, to allow an opening for her political opponents to attack, you know, the sort of coziness of the Clinton Foundation with other governments who have been involved, foreign governments and with corporations. That said, she can't, and the Clintons can't actually run from this thing that has defined their, you know, their public position since Bill Clinton left the White House. They mm-hmm. do have to define it. They can't sort of avoid it. They do have to speak, I think, more forcefully about the good, if any, that it has done, and why it was that they felt that that was an important way for them to have an impact on social change outside of the White House.
Let's talk about Donald Trump and voting here. This is problematic on many fronts, but he keeps on this theme of Democrats are going to win an election only by stealing the election through fraudulent voting. The only legitimate election, of course, would be his victory, probably. Yeah. So he says this in Pennsylvania. The only way we can lose, in my opinion, I really mean this, Pennsylvania, is if cheating goes on. And he's introduced by a local Republican official from Philadelphia, a city with a large African-American population, which, you know, take from that what you will. But he also told a rally in Wilmington, North Carolina, without strict voter identification laws, people will be voting 15 times for Hillary. Then he calls for people to sign up as election workers, which fuels some concerns, understandably, about voter intimidation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, where to begin, Kathleen? There's so much here. First of all, the idea that Donald Trump could only lose Pennsylvania if there were cheating going on is absurd. No Democrat has lost Pennsylvania since, I believe, 1988. I believe that's right, if not 1998. So, you know, obviously he's seeing what's happening in the polls, and he's doing something that I think has a number of different motives and impacts. He's able to say, one, I'm a winner. I've always been a winner. I'll still be a winner, because, of course, we know that the thing that Donald Trump, the personality, hates the most is to be a loser. So he is cultivating this sort of cult of personality around him that he wants to be able to survive after an election that he may lose. And so he will even further alienate that base of his supporters from the government, from the rest of the American people, because if they believe that the election was stolen from him. So that manages to keep him popular within his base of supporters and alienate his base of supporters from sort of the rest of the government, which is, I think, benefits him and is deeply damaging to us and to our social fabric. He also does that in a way where he makes African-American and, you know, in other places, probably Latino voters, criminals. Right? Mm-hmm. The idea that people would care so much about voting, which is something we have to work very hard to get people to do in this country, that they would risk jail time by going 15 times is absurd. And it's been proven that voter fraud is less likely to happen than being struck by lightning. But it also is a way to keep up this sort of dog whistle that people of color are willing to be criminals more than white people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that he's doing by this. And then third, what he's doing is deflecting from the actual rigging of the elections that's happening, which is from his own party. Since 2010, dozens of laws have been introduced and passed to actually rig the outcomes of the elections by making it harder for some people who are citizens and are registered to vote to cast their ballot, or people who are eligible to register. And we've just seen in the past couple of months high courts in this country say that these laws, including voter ID and the targeted repeal of other pro-voter laws, have been intentionally discriminatory. In North Carolina, the judge said that it was with surgical precision that the legislature tried to find the ways that African Americans turn out to vote and eliminate them. So if anybody is rigging an election in this country, it is Donald Trump's own party.
Mm. Well, do you have any sense, because some of these laws have been overturned, is there going to be, do you think, Heather, any kind of Supreme Court action on the issue of voter ID before November, or do you not expect that?
I don't expect there to be action on the Supreme Court before November. I think that what we've seen at the appellate court level has been positive steps, as the records have clearly shown what those of us who work in this area know to be true, that the myth of voter fraud surged into the political debate after the first African-American president was elected with record turnout among young people and communities of color. This is a situation where the Republican Party has been faced with a choice. Either expand their message, reject the racist Southern strategy that has really demonized, often, you know, subconsciously and without actually using words about race, but demonized people of color as undeserving minorities, and tried to win create a party that is really racially segregated and that is sort of wins on white fear and distrust of our fellow Americans. They could have rejected that as the country has become more diverse, but instead, in many ways, they've doubled down. Donald Trump is just, in some ways, the sort of personification of a strategy that has been going on for a very long time.
Mm. Let's look at this number, Heather, which is really quite something after all that's happened with his campaign and with some of his statements. Donald Trump still leads among white men without college degrees by 40 points.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
Yep. Yeah. So white men without college degrees a generation ago were able to have a pretty secure middle class life. Due to manufacturing jobs, the just general sort of ability to get into management positions without, you know, sort of being challenged by a large number of educated women. This is now not the case, and incomes have fallen precipitously for white men without a college degree. And there's something very powerful in our politics, which is the experience of decline. I've said this before, but oftentimes when you're used to privilege, equality actually feels like oppression. And so we could have done a number of things in this country, A, to prevent that wage decline. For example, you know, had better trade deals that are written by and for the American people and not just by and for multinational corporations. We could also have made it easier, not harder, for people to join unions. You'll notice that people, white men without college degrees who are in unions, tend to vote more Democratic. We could have also had tax policies and political policies in terms of money and politics that kept the balance between employers and workers more even. But because, and in many ways because of a conservative shift in our politics over the last 40 years, we did none of those things. We have now created a situation where working class white men have a lot of grievances. And here comes Donald Trump saying, here is who should be your scapegoat. And it's incredibly divisive, but I would say that in some ways Democrats have a lot to put on their plate as well, as in terms of how they managed to lose the white working class, particularly white working class men, by not being not having the backbone often over the course of the last, 20 years to really stand up to employers and to sort of collective corporate power to make sure that workers get a fair shake.
Mm. Well, working class African-American men have had the same set of woes. Why aren't they supporting...
If not much worse,
exactly.
In fact.
So why are they supporting? Why aren't they supporting Donald Trump?
You know, it's funny. I think Donald Trump really thought for a while that he might be able to get working class African-American men, really tried to pit African-Americans against Latinos, saying, you know, immigrants are stealing your jobs. And but that hasn't resonated. And I think a big part of it is that African-American working class men understand that the solutions that the Republicans have offered up are in fact the same policies that have got us in this mess, whether it's massive tax cuts for the wealthy. You know, Donald Trump's tax proposals would be give him, his family, and his corporate enterprises huge tax breaks, and would further starve public schools and our neighborhoods. They have no plans on affordable housing, none on mass incarceration, on health care, all the things that are actually, you know, the public policies that would make a difference in the lives of working class communities. So I think that African American working class people, and I would just say that the working class, defined as those without a college degree in the labor force, are now actually a majority of them are women and people of color. So this, we often in the media focus on white men as a sort of hard hat working class, but that's actually the minority. And my colleague Tamara Drought wrote a beautiful new book called Sleeping Giant about the transformation of the working class. But African Americans and women in the working class, first of all, are not responsive to Republican dog whistling and division. And then they also know that even though Democrats have not always been successful at getting their policies passed, the agendas of the Democrats tend to be more supportive of rebuilding the pathways to the middle class that have been torn apart over the past 40 years.
Heather McGee, our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political. We're welcoming your phone calls. We started with the Clinton Foundation having their 12th annual meeting, I believe, and some Democrats are concerned that it highlights problems that Hillary Clinton has with her campaign. They are concerned about the governments that will be there, the donations and the ties to Middle Eastern governments, also major corporations that may have business with the government, pharmaceuticals being mentioned, energy companies, and certainly bankers. Donald Trump is calling on Clinton to shut down the foundation and return the donations to countries that he says have influenced her while she was Secretary of State. Does it make sense, considering that she might be vulnerable here to... not that they're going to cancel it, it's not very far away, but for them to not have the 12th annual meeting. Donald Trump, we've been talking a lot about what he's been saying about potential fraud. He's calling on people to sign up as election watchers and poll workers, and saying that the only way that he could lose a state like Pennsylvania, he said this while he was in Pennsylvania, was through cheating. And he says he really means that if cheating goes on, that's the reason that he will have lost Pennsylvania. It's a theme that he's on in other states as well. Is it a self-fulfilling kind of prophecy that will all but ensure claims of fraud from his poll watchers and also making the election seem not legitimate? There are many other things that we want to talk about. There's been a big shakeup in the leadership of the Donald Trump campaign. We'll talk about his new CEO from the Conservative News website. We'll talk about his speech that will be delivered sometime this week. And there's some question about whether what he's going to say about immigration, that indications are it may not be as tough as what he has said previously. Where do you think the state of the race is on this August 22nd? Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page, where we always love to read your comments, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, full line of phones going here. We start with Peter in Baraboo. Heather, hi, Peter.
Hi, thank you so much, Kathleen. Once again, kudos to your guest. Absolutely right on. The trends are not new. We have seen this in the past. where divide and conquer techniques have been used to separate citizens who have common interests. And I think what Donald Trump has done on one end and what Bernie Sanders has done on the other is to acknowledge the fact that there is a tremendous sense of disconnect and frustration. The difference, of course, is the answers which each of those ideologies, if you will, provides. Trump's takes us back to fascism, as we know. Bernie Sanders and potentially Hillary Clinton with the progressive movement applying more pressure to her campaign will once again bring us more toward a centrist governing. That will never happen until citizens are educated in terms of how elected officials, both at the county level, the state level, and the national level, through gerrymandering, have completely redefined how we govern. Until we reverse political gerrymandering, all of the goals and objectives that we have for the future are going to be in question. I'll take my answer, if you will, or comment back off the air.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for the work you all do.
Thanks. Thanks, Peter, for the call. Heather.
Thank you, Peter. I think, you know, Peter could be on the show. Peter's got a lot of insights about what's going on. It's very much true, I think, that we are witnessing a real shakeup of American politics, left, right, and center. And it's exciting in some ways for me and for Demos, which is an organization that really sits at the intersection of race and class, that really is trying to tackle inequality in our democracy and our economy, to recognize that right now the bases of both parties, the working and middle class folks who comprise the voters and the would-be voters of both parties, are breaking from what's been something of a bipartisan elite policy consensus around the way to grow the economy, which is from the top down, the role of global trade that's driven by corporate interests, in creating, you know, an economically dynamic society, and of course, you know, sort of how generous we need public investments to be. Yes, there have been lots of fights between Democrats and Republicans over the past 20 years, but in some ways, the sort of center of the two parties in Washington has been far to the right of where most Americans are, including Republicans and Democrats on core economic concerns. Most Republicans want higher taxes on the wealthy. They're interested in things like paid family leave and more support for child care. They're interested in things like debt-free public college because they know that that's the system that we had just 30 years ago and that helped make the greatest middle class the world has ever known. The idea that we should sort of cut everything public in order to reward the wealth and shield the wealth of the already wealthy is a pretty fringe idea, and yet it's what we've been doing in Washington, with a few exceptions when Democrats were able to break through, particularly between 2009 and 2011 when they had all houses of Congress and the White House. So I think we're going to see more of kind of an economic populism on the right. The big question of our time, though, is it going to be a nativist, exclusionary, racially intolerant, and scapegoating economic populism, or is it going to be one that recognizes that working families of all races are really just out for the same common goal, which is an American dream that has always been created by and with immigrants and African Americans in this country? And that's the question. And Trump, even if he does not win in November, his supporters and the media infrastructure that helped create the mythologies and the lies behind his campaign are not going anywhere.
Would you agree, Heather, that she, Hillary Clinton, would be heading a centrist kind of government?
That she would be in terms of that she...
Her policies would be centrist, not progressive.
That's a really good question. So, you know, as I was saying, in some ways, the structure of our, you know, big money politics makes any government under this system of campaign finance a centrist, quote-unquote, government, in that it's sort of in the center of the donor class, and we know from research that we've done at Demos, have more conservative economic ideas than the rest of the population. So in some ways, she, as was President Obama, as are many people, until we really get campaign finance reform and really have, you know, much stronger voting laws and a culture of voting and organization and civic health that make the people really, the people's voices more able to be heard in government, it's going to be more centrist. It's going to be more skewed towards those who already have enough money to influence mm-hmm. elections. That said, and I think that Bernie Sanders should take a lot of credit for this, but so, frankly, should Occupy Wall Street and the Movement for Black Lives and the Dreamers. Her campaign promises and the Democratic platform have been far more progressive than any we've seen in generations. You know, we don't really talk about this that often, but when Bill Clinton came into office, he was part of a movement to bring the Democrats to a more corporate center on the economy and on issues like welfare reform and criminal justice. And I think Hillary Clinton is in an interesting spot because she doesn't want to completely repudiate the presidency of her husband and the time she spent in the White House there. But she's actually charting out a different kind of argument about what it means to be a Democrat, and I think in some ways a different person with exactly the, her same politics and policy platform would be able to say that more clearly. Say, I'm not a new Democrat. I'm not a blue dog Southern Democrat. I am a, you know, I am a progressive, and I actually think that the party has changed and needs to change from when my husband was in office.
Let's go to Nancy in Milwaukee next. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I'd like to state at the beginning that I am not voting for Trump or Clinton. But what the reason I'm calling today is that there was a very interesting article in the paper last week titled, No Record That Clinton or Her Aides Did Ethics Training. There is no evidence that Hillary Clinton or her top aides completed ethics training when they started at the State Department as required by federal law. The State Department records show that only three of her nine top aides took the mandated training, but it also shows that that all other records are totally lost. In all fairness, the article also does say that merely because they don't have a record does not mean that the people did not take the training. But on the other hand, with all of the other baggage that she's got, wouldn't you think that since last week when this article appeared across the whole of the United States, that Hillary would have been shouting from the rooftops, yes, yes, we all did take it, and I will forthwith prove it. But that has not happened. And the very fact that she knew this law existed and she didn't immediately put forth those records at the start of her campaign, that is, again, saying, I am above the law, and that the state, and I don't require the State Department to even keep accurate records. You know, this is just one more piece of all of this crap that has been in her background. I do have to admit she's obviously the most knowledgeable person about the running of the government, but I do not trust her at all.
So, Nancy, and I missed this story. Maybe Heather knows more about it, but I just want to ask you, are you going to sit out the presidential part of the ballot, or what are you going to do?
I heard Dr. Jill Stein speak on several occasions, and I'm tempted to vote for her.
Okay.
She is a practicing physician, but she's a Harvard graduate. She certainly can't be in the 70% IQ. I feel there is too much that Clinton has dragged behind her.
Thank you, Nancy.
Never been answered, and she will not open up for a press conference.
Yeah, she's been remiss in not having press conferences. Well, what do you think? Are you aware of this ethics training at the State Department? I wasn't aware of this, Heather.
No, this is news to me. Thanks, Nancy, for being an avid reader of the news. And we, you know, Nancy's overall point, I mean, in some ways, you know, when you're reading the news, you find things that oftentimes support suspicions and beliefs that you already have. Nancy's overall point is one that is shared very widely right now, and it is a major problem. And I think the Clinton campaign has known from the beginning that their numbers on trustworthiness in polling are very bad, and that is a sort of her major Achilles heel. There was a poll out recently, just last week, I think from NBC News, showing that Donald Trump's are just 5 points behind. Both of them have very high negatives, but what you are starting to see is that on the just general question of do you think this person is honest and trustworthy, in some ways after 25 years of scandals and of being sort of profiled in the media, not always in positive ways, you know, those numbers are really very low for Hillary Clinton and for the Clintons. They're almost just as bad for Donald Trump after just about a year of campaigning. And where the Clinton campaign, I think, is pointing now is saying, yes, but they trust her now more on the economy and more on national security. So I think that's the question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this person is trustworthy in general, when the theme in the media has been that she's not for most of your lifetime, but when it comes down to it, voters trust her with the economy, they trust her with national security, they trust her with the decisions and the judgment and the issues that will actually affect their lives. But that's not all to dismiss at all what Nancy's saying and the spirit behind it. And I think it's time for a movement in politics that, frankly, is beyond the presidential campaign, that does restore some sense of trust in government and some sense of trust in one another. But I think we would be foolish to try to wait for a candidate to try to do that for us. Mm. That only we can do that for ourselves.
And KP, our producer, checked on this. McClatchy and The Hill both reported on that story, if we want to look it up, on ethics. So, Nancy, thank you for bringing that to our attention. Let's go to Ed next. And by the way, we have a couple lines open now. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we are taking your phone calls as we continue with All Things Political. Ed in West Allis, hi.
Well, I noticed your guest did not mention the work that we in the labor movement did in 2011 to take the fight to Walker on Act 10. To recall him, and then to take the fight to Walker again on right to work. We are just always abused in organized labor. We never get on talk shows. Meet the Press never has Trumka on panel of the DS. And the thing is that Donald Trump is not going to get the 40% of unionized households that people are speculating that he's going to receive in August. We're going to drink this bitter pill and vote for Hillary, just as we voted for Obama when he said that if anyone tried to mess with organized labor, he might just have to put on his sneakers and run to that state and fight for the rights of organized labor. He never did. He never showed up in Wisconsin. We never got the Employee Free Choice Act. And don't think that we're going to be fooled by Trump.
Heather.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller for calling in and for saying I didn't note the importance of the fight back in Wisconsin when I listed out the different movements that have changed our political atmosphere in this country, and I should have, and I'm remiss on it. And he's right. 100% right, and I did talk about the importance of unions in the attack on unions as being why it is that we have so much economic inequality, why it is that wages have fallen, particularly for white men without degrees. If there were one single thing that I could do and wave a magic wand, or that we could do through creating a movement to break through the sort of elite policy consensus right now, it'd be to make it easier for people to join a union. And that is because the basic desire to have a say over the conditions at your work is a fundamental human yearning, and it should be a human right. And that we have all done better when more people have had that right, that the middle class's share of the national take-home pay has been larger when we've had more people working under union contracts, and it's declined as there's been this relentless attack on labor. And I completely agree about the lack of a labor voice in the sort of elite policy conversations. I try to bring that perspective whenever I am on television, but there is nothing like having a Mary Kay Henry, who's the head of the Service Employees International Union, or a Trumka, who's the head of AFL-CIO, being able to speak directly for working people. The Fight for 15, which is something that has been supported by labor movements around the country and organizations around the country, is something that has completely changed the political calculus. It's made $15 in a union a demand that is being heard. Cities are raising their minimum wage to $15 an hour over time. Even red states have been passing ballot initiatives to raise their rate above the poverty rate that is the federal minimum wage. So you're absolutely right that labor at this moment of being really back on its heels from an incredible amount of assault from political devotees of the Koch brothers and others, you know, no more vivid example, obviously, than right there in Wisconsin, are fighting back. They're fighting back with a new constituency. Again, if you want to read more about this idea of sort of what labor is now, what the working class is now, my colleague's book, Sleeping Giant, How the Rise of the New Working Class Will Transform America, which is out on Doubleday Press, is a great, great place to start.
Great, and we'll get that for a show, too. Let's go to Elaine in Wautoma next. Hello, Elaine.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a point that I don't know if a lot of people know about. I have a lot of Christian friends, and they kind of turned me into YouTube, where there's a lot of Christian shows. And my Christian friends often have visions or dreams from God. And there's been a lot of Christians that have been having dreams and visions about Donald Trump. And the one that really spoke out to me was Donald Trump elected prophetic vision. But this wasn't a show. This was just a Christian lady that had this vision, or this dream, actually. And in her dream, some man came out to the election polls and said that the election machines were rigged. And he pointed out where they were rigged in all different states so that they could actually fix the election. And in the end of her prophetic dream, we had to vote by paper ballots, and Donald Trump won. But there's a lot of Christian shows out there with a lot of Christians having dreams about Donald Trump, that he's going to save our country from the Illuminati and, you know, Hillary and George Bush are both with the New World Order.
All right, let's not go there. But I wasn't aware that there were a lot of YouTubes about this very issue. Are you aware of this, Heather?
I'm not, but I'm not surprised. I think one of the major features of our democracy that we really have not yet contended with is how many different messages different audiences are getting.
Right.
The person who just came over to take over the Trump campaign is obviously someone who has created out of Breitbart News a whole community of people who are part of what's known now as the alt-right, which is folks who have views that in many ways many American families would think of as fringe, but are being sort of catapulted into the mainstream because of social media, because you can find someone who validates your fears and your beliefs and your viewpoints by just, you know, logging on, and because these very well-funded online networks are sort of amplifying it. And then, of course, there's also Fox News, which does a lot of the tilling of the soil itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I talked earlier in the show about the incredibly damaging work that is being done when Donald Trump says that he is that the election system is rigged. It's something that is very easy to believe, and in some ways it's sad because one of the reasons why it's easy to believe is because of the election problems that were deliberate in 2000 that were in favor of George W. Bush, and the fact that there's been so much media coverage about changes in voting laws that have been driven by Republicans. And now it's very easy for him to sort of take that cynicism about the elected officials who are controlling our voting systems and say that and marry that with an idea that people of color are so criminal that they would try to steal an election to just justify the idea that he is a natural winner, even though his he has managed to alienate almost every single population group in the country.
You mentioned Stephen Bannon. E.J. Dionne had an interesting piece a few days ago saying that that Stephen will steer Donald Trump in the direction of the European far right. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that this E.J. is very smart, and is very smart to make that point. These set of questions about how to react to widening inequality, which is happening in the U.S. at an accelerated rate because we sort of do less in terms of benefits and progressive taxation to make up for market inequalities. But in Europe, it's happening as well, although, of course, the blow is a lot softer when you have national health care and paid leave and child care and more job security and higher unions. But that said, in Europe and in the U.S., families are experiencing a change in the economic social contract, and that has a lot to do with the way that our countries have written the rules of globalization to make it easier for multinational corporations to profit and harder for workers to have a voice and have a decent standard of living. And you can go two ways with that set of trends. You can either rally against the people who are actually writing the rules, and that's what organized labor has done, that's what Occupy, the Fight for 15, the WTO, anti-WTO movements have done, as well as the racial justice movements across the country, or you can scapegoat those who are, frankly, the most vulnerable, refugees, people of color, immigrants, and it's a fight for the soul of our country and of countries across Western Europe. And if you add to that the fear of physical violence, of terrorism after September 11th, which of course has been much more of a problem in countries like Turkey and countries like Bangladesh and Indonesia and places where the violence has sort of crept into their societies to a much greater degree than it has for us in the U.S., even thinking about the terrible losses of life that have happened since September 11th, you've got a powder keg, and it's a time for strong leadership that makes us feel like we can follow our hopes and not just our fears, and that is sort of the question of the day right now with this election.
Heather McGee is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, director of the Washington Office of Demos and president of Demos Action. And here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655. As we get closer to the election, we like to read your comments on our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let us go next to Lou in Cudahy. Hi, Lou.
Hello, this is just leftist catechism on parade. We see Hillary Clinton taking money through the Clinton Foundation from her, you know, people who want to influence the American political system, and George Soros advising her campaign. And so the 25-plus years of the baggage that comes behind the lying, corruption, all that stuff, that is not America, and that is not us. People resent that, and they're going to vote this person out. He's not going to get elected. The moral order of society, we see the left undermining America, deconstructing America, and the idea that we should have children have pick their own gender identity and then use the bathroom of their choice offends America greatly, but the left doesn't see that. They see that as progress, hence the word progressive. It's not progressive. It's a collapse of moral order.
Well, there are people who have different views on that, certainly. Lou, who are you voting for?
Donald Trump.
Do you think he's a moral man?
I do. I think he believes in America. The left is not. The left is deconstructing America, and the left, America and its constitution are repugnant to the left and Democrats.
Heather.
You know, the caller, I'm glad the caller called in. I'm glad the caller is willing to talk about his views, and you know, particularly when he knows that there's a progressive on the line here. I think that kind of dialogue is actually really important. You know, the examples that the caller gave about what progressives stand for around the what are known as sort of the culture wars, I think are some of our hardest considerations. That said, I take a lot of hope in the progress that has been made just over the past 10 years, really, on the issue of marriage equality. It's true that if you grew up in a family with where, you know, same-sex relationships, where, you know, gender identities expressing themselves in different ways was something that was completely foreign to you, if you grew up in a church that didn't approve of these things, this can seem like a massive threat to your way of life and to the beliefs that you have and the culture that you grew up in. That said, this country has to be understood as being made up of people that are more than just your own family and your own background. And what was able to happen with the issue of marriage equality that I think gives us hope for lots of issues like that, where the question really is about, does everyone have the right to the pursuit of happiness as long as it harms no other person? Or is it just people who are, you know, from a certain background that has been the sort of dominant background in our politics and in our population over the course of our history? So the fact that so many Americans who were not originally supportive of marriage equality were able to move on that issue because they saw that the values that sort of are deeper than, you know, the value of a man and a woman being the marital unit, but rather the value of love and of people who are seeking to make a family, being able to make that family, the value of the pursuit of happiness, the value of individual freedom, that those values are actually deeper than whatever their expression might be at any given moment in our history. That's what I hope will keep us making progress. You know, I'm a millennial. I'm 36 years old. Even for me, I'm noticing, like, the generation younger than me pushing me on some of the things mm-hmm. that I sort of took for granted about the way we live in the world. And that's, in many ways, what makes life beautiful and worth living. Now, when it comes to, you know, what's tearing America apart, as the caller said, undermining the idea of America, frankly, I think that the betrayal of work and the inability for people to be able to educate themselves into the middle class without going into ruinous debt is more of a betrayal of America than a bathroom that has a man and a woman sign on it.
Heather, thank you very much for being with us. It was a great hour. Join
Thank
us
you.
Again. Thanks,
Thank
Heather.
You,
Heather McGee, president of the Demos and also president of Demos Action, a frequent guest on Meet the Press and many other national television shows, and a writer for a number of publications. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing this show. Thanks for your calls. If you didn't get on the air, you can leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. News is coming up. And our guest the next hour of the program will say that war is in decline.